Well, welcome everybody. Yes, it sounds like this is working, which is great. We'll start pretty much on time to get going. And thank you for coming along. You're obviously drawn in by that piece of wording around hot topics in ERM. So what we've done, not to disappoint you, is we've looked at the challenges that are facing, which is why the screen looks a little bit different perhaps to what you're expecting. But you are in the right room. The way we'll run this session is Mike Thornton will give us a sort of 10 to 12 minute presentation, setting out some of the challenges that he sees and raising some questions. And then after that, we'll have about a half an hour to take your questions on anything that Mike presents or on anything beyond that that you think is relevant to enterprise risk management today. We've got a very experienced bunch of people here on the panel. I'll start with Mike. I love these formal bios, by the way. They're great. So, to do them justice, you really have to read them. So Mike is an experienced and enthusiastic chief risk officer. Now, who'd have thought that would go together? With over 25 years' experience in life insurance and wealth management, and a lot of that has been at AXA and the AMP, and not just in Australia, overseas as well, in the UK and Asia. He's held a wide range of roles, including Group Chief Risk Officer, Group Chief Actuary, and Appointed Actuary, and has done a lot with high-performing teams over that process. So there's been a lot happening in the world of AXA and AMP, I know, for the last several years, and it was quite an accomplishment for Mike to get that group CRO position at the time. Currently, Mike's chief risk officer for AIA, Australia and New Zealand, so he's back to Melbourne, as you've all flocked here today. The right spot, is that right, Mike? Now we've Simone Lees, and Simone is currently head of group risk and compliance at Clearview, and that role involves risk management and group compliance, and it's across life insurance, superannuation, there's a dealer group as well, and a whole wealth management business there as well. Previously also head of capital management at Clearview, those things are quietly connected, and began her career at Old Mutual in South Africa in various actuarial roles before moving then to the UK, worked at Mercer for a while, then came back to be a risk manager at AXA UK first, and then came back to Australia. So one of the key things that's pretty common across this group here is because it's an RMPC-sponsored session, people have either been a member of the RMPC, in Tim's case, are currently members, which is Mike and Simone. And Tim, I'm not quite sure if you were ever actually in the RMPC, but you've been very close to it, doing presentations and the like over the years. So coming on to Tim then, Tim has over 20 years financial services experience, and that's in life insurance, superannuation, and banking as well. And within that has worked in capital management. Currently working as, where are we? I'm not sure if this is current, but head of performance innovation and head of strategy. And what's your current role?
Not quite, and for a lot. Senior manager of NABWealth Transformation.
So a lot happening. And in the past, that banking experience has included being involved in credit risk as well. So capital management, credit risk, and right across the superannuation side now of risk management. Tim Clark is chief actuary at joined IAG November 2010 as the chief actuary, responsible for leading the group actuarial and capital function, and has looked after insurance liabilities and capital modelling. Joined the personal insurance division of IAG as Executive General Manager of Risk and Performance in 2014. His role is the responsibility to ensure that personal insurance achieves its short and long-term targets within risk appetite, very important, through the provision of financial and risk information, insight and challenge to create effective decision making. In February 2016, Tim was appointed as Executive General Manager Commercial in the Australian Consumer Division. And prior to IAG, Tim spent 19 years at Swiss Re, and some of that in Switzerland. And that ranged from Australia, Switzerland, Hong Kong, and the UK. So 20 years plus experience as a risk manager and as an actuary, and general insurance is a specialty there. Thank you very much. I'll hand over to Mike and he'll run through the presentation. And what I'd like you to do is think of all the hard questions you can ask us.
Okay, thanks very much, Sean, for the kind introductions. Prior to joining AIA as their chief risk officer, I spent 4 years in Sydney working with AMP. And over the past few years, I've reached out to many CROs and risk management teams. The first CRO role appeared in GE in 1993. So as a profession, it remains relatively new. Thinking is evolving and the three lines of defence continues to mature. So in that context and for something so new, it's not unreasonable for the CRO role and for risk management teams to go through periods of transformation. And in my view, we're going through one right now. Over the next 10 minutes or so, I'm going to share some common challenges being faced by CROs and their teams. And I'll outline how those teams are typically responding. Sean's going to then facilitate a discussion with you and with the panel. If you're an actuary here and you're working in risk management teams, we'll be interested in whether some of these challenges resonate with you and interested in how you and your teams are responding to them. If you don't work in risk management, we're still interested in your views because I think you've got a role to play in helping risk management teams transform. And finally, we'll ask whether these challenges are also relevant for you in your roles and relevant for your teams. I see risk management teams tackling some very difficult challenges. And I think regardless of what role you're in, I think you ignore these at your peril. So be warned. So these are eight typical challenges that are top of mind for me. And I won't explicitly cover all of these, but I will talk around many of them. Firstly, it's not easy to explain a team's value proposition. If we're going to be effective as a business enabler, risk management teams need to be able to work collaboratively with other business units and need to be clear on what they bring to the table. That's going to require a high level of collaboration, and business leaders need to know when do they reach out to their risk management teams and what can they expect in return. Being clear on the value we add is critical. And if we're not clear and can't explain it, our delivery is likely to fall short. And the stakes are high. Expectations are increasing all the time. And teams are being challenged to deliver more value add with less resources. We now have CROs sitting on leadership teams up and down businesses. And that's resetting expectations of what can and should be delivered. In turn, that's impacting what's expected of risk management teams, and business leaders are quite rightly wanting a higher level of value-adding proactive engagement. So determining how that engagement should work is a key priority for many teams, and doing this well should help support organisational agility. The more embedded risk management is, and the more proactive and engaged we are, the better place and the easier it will be for us to respond to issues as they crop up. And as the three lines of defence continues to mature, there is a need to revisit who does what and how the three lines best work together. If risk teams are to add more value with less resources, we're clearly going to need more capable people. And the first line of defence will need to take on more responsibilities. And that means that the tools we use need to be intuitive, easy, and really engaging to use. Risk reporting is a real challenge. I feel like I'm just listing lots of challenges here. There are lots of challenges. Risk reporting is a challenge. How do you best aggregate risks across businesses? And how do you create impactful risk reporting, not just at the group level, but also for any relevant subsidiaries? How do you do that cost effectively? And how do you avoid reporting on things that have just happened in the past? One senior CRO in Australia said to me, we're so busy addressing risks and reporting issues, we don't have time to look ahead. And that's a real problem for a risk management team. Finally, risk culture and conduct are highly topical at the moment, and teams have an important role to play in supporting businesses. We've got to be realistic, though. These are organisational challenges, and risk management teams alone won't be able to drive improvements if that's not supported by a more broader organisational push. All business leaders have a role to play here in setting the expectations of staff and then holding them to account. And CROs, leadership teams and boards all have a role to play in prioritising this, being passionate about its importance and calling out behaviour that falls short of what we expect. And companies that don't routinely do that are going to have a problem, particularly when ASIC come and ask boards what they're doing about conduct. So how are teams responding to these challenges, and do you think those challenges are relevant for you? So I've already touched on many of these responses, but I'll elaborate on these a little. Now, the theme of this conference is all about reimagining the future, and many teams are taking the opportunity to reinvent and transform themselves. Strategically, you know, that's language that everybody's now familiar with. So at one level, there's never been a better time to take a step back and consider what we do and how we might do it differently. Business models are being redefined and challenged, and all businesses are considering how they increase organisational agility, how they respond to disruption, and how they can reduce their cost base all at the same time. So risk management teams are taking the opportunity to rethink how they increase their agility, how they get closer to their stakeholders, and how they do more with less. Teams are getting closer to their customers by working collaboratively with business leaders, by developing business partnering roles, and where practical, joining the leadership teams of the businesses they support, not just at the CRO level, but also at a lower level down through the risk teams. And I think this is important in really understanding in real time the sorts of issues that business leaders are grappling with. If we've got people sitting on leadership teams, we're going to need to upskill our people. We need to be effective at that level. We need to be able to engage with business leaders. We need to be commercial and to be able to communicate effectively. Most importantly, we need people who have the credibility and the experience to be able to challenge constructively. And finding the people with the skills to do that is not easy. Pretty much every risk team in Australia is looking for people with a higher level of capability. Companies are also redefining roles and responsibilities. And in my view, the term three lines of defence is getting a little dated. I'm expressing the various roles and responsibilities slightly differently now as risk ownership, risk oversight and risk assurance. And using similar high-level articulations, companies are rethinking who does what and why. On risk reporting, teams are expected to call out what they're worried about, why they're concerned, and what the management team are doing about it. You're expected to look ahead, look beyond the immediate issue, to be insightful and to express a point of view. And none of those things are easy. I constantly ask myself, what's my main message here, and what sort of discussion do I want this to generate? And finally, to influence culture, We need to be able to coach business leaders on the behaviours expected in their teams and to highlight areas where those might not be playing out in practice. Not easy for actuaries to do that. So these are fundamental challenges and fundamental changes that are helping us meet those increased expectations. And you have a role to play. So what does that look like? Well, if you're an appointed actuary, when you review risk management in the financial condition report, are you challenging sufficiently? Do you know what good looks like? And how do you keep abreast of changing expectations? What are you doing to raise awareness of conduct risk and to increase organisational agility? Is there a role for here? Is there a role for you here or your team? And how are you personally highlighting what you need to do differently? If you're running an actuarial team, are there benefits of working with your CRO to raise standards? I would encourage you all to do that. And this will likely benefit both of you. And done well, more constructive challenge will likely benefit your business. Capital and risk management need to go hand in hand. They need to be joined at the hip and embedded in your corporate DNA. So that's one key area where you really have to work together. Finally, I just want to say a few words about what these challenges might mean personally for you. As individuals, we all need to challenge ourselves and from time to time reinvent what we bring to our role and to our company. And the challenges I've just stepped through largely relate to value add, business engagement, agility, capability and influence. And those are things that ought to be relevant for everybody in this room. So I'd encourage you to ask yourself, are expectations of you increasing? And what are you doing to rise to the challenge? And that's it from me. Over to you, Sean.
Well, thanks very much, Mike. There you go. Lots to think about. So, and that's coming from the experience of someone who's been in the position and had to work through a lot of these challenges. And of course, it's an ongoing challenge for all of us. Just in terms of the housekeeping, if you could please, the session's being recorded. If you could pop up and talk through the microphone, that'd be fantastic. We'd appreciate that. And we'll pass a microphone around the panel here as we go as well. Okay, so there's really two sets of questions here. How are companies responding to these challenges? And what's the role of actuaries in helping us move forward and get the teams working well? Can I ask, how many of you actually work within a risk function? So, Mansa, you're going to get a lot of questions. Thank you. And the rest of you, are you in support roles in an indirect or, I suppose, indirect way?
What's some of you? Yeah,
how many
reserving actuaries? How many crossing actuaries?
The reserving? Yeah, a bunch of those. No, no, that's absolutely right. Yeah, I suppose the context from an enterprise risk management perspective is the CRO perspective that Mike's walked us through. And then there's all the support that goes behind that, which is really the kernel and where most of us have an opportunity to play. So who'd like to ask the first question or make the first observation on either of these two elements? Maybe we'll go back to the challenges. An idea? Okay, go ahead. Yeah, if you could take that. And just if you could state your name as well, please, just before you start.
Yeah, Wayne Brazel. Look, if we go to the next slide, just that last point, is risk and capital management sufficiently embedded in your corporate DNA? I think so. For me, I'm reading that question as in risk as the risk function. But that certainly sort of, I guess, raises concerns in my mind in that I sort of see the whole risk management, if you think of a soccer team as an analogy, capital management is the goalkeeper, but you've got all your defence that should be sitting ahead of that. You know, so you need to be optimising your risk, you need to be managing it by far more methods than just having a bucket load of capital there to have if things go awry. So I guess I was, as I say, have a problem with that concept of risk and capital management as though it's the risk function and the capital management. I think there's a lot more, there's embedded options that we have that we don't necessarily price as well as we should. And I think there's some challenges there in how we actually approach the way that we assess and price the risk.
Maybe I can respond to that.
Mike, yep.
Yeah. Okay, well, well done for providing a constructive challenge. Bonus points then, Wayne.
Maybe hold the mic just a little bit closer. Yeah, I think that's sensitive.
So, yeah, I think, let me explain what I had in mind there. So I certainly wasn't talking about risk management teams there, and nor was I talking about capital per se. I'm talking more about the whole ICAP process, you know, which needs to operate as a kind of living, breathing organism that's really embedded in all your key decision-making processes. You know, a culture where risk and capital are informing one another all of the time, independent of the actuarial team and the risk team being involved. So that whole ecosystem. I like your soccer analogy. I'm not sure I'd describe capital management as the goalkeeper. I think I'd probably prefer to think of the ICAP as more the Stephen Gerrard of the team, the guy in the middle of the field who's collating play. But thanks for the question. Yeah, I was thinking much more broadly than that.
But perhaps Tim might like to comment from the general insurance perspective.
Yeah, so it's quite interesting when you think about capital. One of the scenarios we actually took to my board when we were doing the ICAP scenarios around capital was actually we thought about the ability to raise capital down the future if you have the Nat Cat that goes through the top of your reinsurance tower, which are one of the key general insurance risks. And if you still had a brand, actually the difference between the net assets you've got on your balance sheet and the market price of your stock is actually the amount of capital, assuming nothing changes, you can theoretically raise tomorrow. If you wipe out the total capital base, you know, in IAG's case where I worked, I think, depending on the share price, but it was something like 2 to 3 times the net assets of the company. It was how much they valued the brand and the management and everything of the company. So you can theoretically raise that capital straight afterwards. So how do you link that into the your thinking about how to protect yourself, because actually the brand probably would survive. Society would have gone through such a wipeout that every general insurance company would be suffering pretty badly at the same time. But it will be a bit reluctant, so you wouldn't get the full value of it. So how much of that capital you bring into it? It was kind of one of the really interesting questions we played around with. You think about, I always think about AIG in this space. A wonderful example of where reputational risk is kind of a curious thing, isn't it? It was AIG, then got $82 billion or $100 billion or whatever it got, rebranded itself to Chartis, and about 4 or 5 years later rebranded itself back to AIG and can still raise capital on that brand. It's kind of, it makes you reflect on kind of your well-held beliefs that reputational risk's king, you know? So I don't know whether it really answered the question. It's just some observations.
To be quite honest.
I just wanted to say my two cents when it comes to risk management and capital is that it's capital is just kept there. Once you've done the risk management and you've decided how much risk you want to hold, then you worry about capital. It shouldn't be combined together at all.
Thanks, Simon.
Thanks.
Martin Lamb from Deloitte. Just going back to the previous slides about companies redefining roles and responsibilities, there's been some discussions that there's overlap between the role of the appointed actuary and the chief risk officer. What is the status of those discussions in terms of redefining roles and responsibilities? A clearer delineation, maybe?
I think in an agile world, actually, you don't worry too much about the clear delineation and you work together. There are still roles that are clearly articulated in an FCR, which doubles up with what a CRO might want to write in a risk reporting. But as long as you actually work it out and you don't have a political infight, it's really easy to solve. You just talk and I'll present on this piece and CRO, you can present on that piece. You know, when we ran the ICAP stress and scenarios, it was quite clearly a combination of the full range of risk management functions of which the reserving actuary and the chief actuary is part of that team. So, I didn't mind it too much. The thing I've been a little bit challenged about was the split of the risk and the audit committees, because one of the things when you're presenting your audit numbers, so the reserves on your balance sheet, how can you present a number without talking about the risk around the numbers? So you kind of have this weird halfway house where you've got to kind of end your audit function talking about the risk around your reserves and then go into the risk function or the risk committee meeting and talk about the risk around the reserves. It's a curious kind of challenge to how you manage things.
Maybe that brings into focus the changing of the three lines of defence that Mike was referring to earlier, and to some extent perhaps there's a bit of a blurring which has been part of the issue to date, but if we look at the different way of considering those lines of defence, as Mike was setting out, what do we want going forward? Anybody like to comment?
So my name is Barry Dillon. I'm a C risk. I'm the only risk person here, so I felt obliged that I should.
Thank you.
So I suppose I don't really have my comment is I like to find that you made my about sitting in LT meetings for the business, because I suppose if you were to use Alicia Campbell's analogy this morning on the stop sign, if risk managers are seen as the people holding the stop sign, then you're never going to get an integrated approach to risk management. Whereas if we're seen as the people working and developing the triangle, in other words, the business plan that she alluded to, I think you get more of a collaborative approach in managing risk with the business. So I think that's very important. But I think equally as well, risk managers have a responsibility to coordinate a view across business units as well. So if you look at, like, in life insurance risk, you have separate teams on retention, claims, underwriting, pricing. We as risk managers need to be running meetings where we're coordinating, and every person on that team has a seat at the table as well. So it generates cross-communication between the teams as well. I mean, take for example, you might be a business unit and you might be looking at your top advisors which are generating sales, but equally you have to look at the amount of advisors that are generating high lapse rates. So unless the two are communicating, you're not going to get an optimal outcome. I think the other thing as well maybe is on, I suppose, non-traditional risks, which sometimes we're somewhat not used to dealing with, like things like brand risk and distribution risk. So I think that's all you kind of need to think outside the box and more commercially, and you really get that by sitting in meetings with the business as well, and you get to go forward position as well by sitting in business meetings with
yes.
I think if you as a risk manager are seen as a commercial person within the business, you've got a commercial outlook. you'll get them to come forward more and take more ownership of the risk as well. Because effectively, as I said, we're not the stop sign holder, we're there to work with the business. So there are my comments, and it's not really a question, it's opening up.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Barry.
Can I just comment on your comment? I totally agree with that. And I think that with us, what we try and do is actually just go and speak and be in the business. So when we do risk reports, you sit at your desk and do it, but when you're out there and you're talking to, it's not only sitting in committee meetings, it's actually just going to have a coffee. And our CRO actually tries to encourage us to not be sitting at our desk and taking people for coffee and just chatting to them and saying, you know, what's going on in your world? And that's how we become part of the business and not holding the stop sign. And they see us as people to come and confide in and, you know, to get consultation on. And so when they are looking at something and they're questioning the risks, then you do find they come and talk to you because you've got that relationship. So totally agree with your points.
I'm increasingly a big fan of this. It's a difficult subject, though. Not all business leaders really embrace it. So it kind of handled with care would be my words of warning. I do think, though, it's important in building trust, in building rapport, in building that relationship with executives. You know, if you're sat there within the team, being part of the solution, being the guy who, as opposed to being the guy who rocks up when there's a problem, it makes it a lot easier for people to deal with you. I've worked with some fantastic people who've had those roles, and the best ones will move their desks so they're sitting down in those teams, if not permanently, then for 2 or 3 days a week. They'll also roll up their sleeves and do some really dirty work from time to time as well, where you could say they're blurring the first and second lines. But the reason they roll up their sleeves is to build that trust and respect and credibility. And knowing how to do that and which things to do it on is really key. But the best ones will always know when to roll up their sleeves and get into the detail. And all for the good of the relationship.
As you will have heard, my previous title was Head of Risk and Performance. And it was deliberately designed that way to achieve exactly that outcome. So my risk advisors actually went in and they sat in the leadership team. Their job, they phrased it as increasing the probability of you hitting your targets, and by working around the kind of adverse outcomes of strategies and actually asking them to take more risk at certain times, they earned their stripes, if you like, so that then they could turn up and talk about more extreme risks because they'd helped in the short-term stuff or the business objectives over the next 12 months, and then they could turn up and do the BCPs and compliance risk and some of the other things that risk professionals turn up and talk about first. So we talked about business, we talked about their outcomes before we even started bringing any ideas to them, and it worked pretty powerfully.
I think a key part of all of that, if we look at the challenges to actuaries, not working within the risk function itself yet, perhaps, is how do we develop the skills to be like to be forward and embrace the business and work in it? I think that's some of the skill sets, perhaps, that Mike was talking about. What do any of you do to embrace your relationships with the business? What works in a practical way? Anybody like to share their thoughts? Barry? It's a long way round to that, Mike.
Yeah, I think a really useful way of doing that is, so take for example an organization, you've got say your retail advice and your group insurance and your bank and direct sign, life insurance company, and I mean there is a void in the gap in the relationship in your actuarial team and your business. That may not be at the leadership level, but below the leadership level, you ask them, and they'll say the actuaries are the guys that crunch the numbers. That's not enough. That's a typical answer you get.
Yeah.
But if you have an actuarial background and you work in risk and you sit in business meetings, then you're bridging that gap, basically, because you're communicating in a non-actuarial language to the business what exactly it is they do and what's important and why it's so important. So then you get appreciation and buy-in from the business on the level of importance in the actual reporting that's produced. You get buy-in to just small things like understanding why assumption setting is so important. So I think, like I see it as bridging a gap between the quantitative modeling, which is critical, but also the other side of the coin, just generating sales, managing relationships.
Yeah, it's crossing over to the true commercial side.
Hi, it's Wayne again. Look, all that's been talked about in terms of particularly Mike, your comments around a good risk management manager, to me that's a good actuary. And you know, so all of my evaluation teams, I've encouraged them to talk with the business, talk with the claims teams, talk with the underwriting teams, and actually understand what's going on in the business. One really good example of how that paid huge dividends is that we were getting a lot of noise in some of our reporting. So we went and talked, this was on a group risk portfolio, so we went and talked to the guys who actually did the admin and explained why it was important that we got sensible data. And it was really quite incredible. First of all, you know, this admin team had never been spoken to by anybody sort of in more the corporate type function, and suddenly they realized they actually had an important role to play. But as we sort of, so their engagement in the whole process went up dramatically. But as we dug into it, we actually found quite a serious risk issue that nobody had ever thought about. I mean, you know, we go out with our group risk, this particular company went out with these group risk quotes every time, and we said, well, you know, if the data provided is in pricing is not actual what we get in reality, then we have the right to reprice, and we have had the right to reprice every 3 years, or sorry, every year based on the movement of the membership base. The people in the administration area who actually look at that and were the ones that should be picking that up had no idea about how that was meant to operate. So we could have had our membership base moved by something like 59% over 3 years, and we would never have triggered a repricing, and yet we could have done it, you know, for much smaller movements in the membership base. So I think, to me, it's the actuaries themselves, they also need to be very much engaged with the business, understand how the business operates so that they can actually identify the gaps.
Thanks, Wayne.
It all seems to be about communication, isn't it? Communication and collaboration in all areas of business, not actuaries, risk management, everyone.
Yeah. That's probably... Sorry.
I was just going to make a couple of observations, but you go.
First off,
so I'm line one in the organisation that I work for, and one thing that I do quite a bit of is deliver change. And in terms of accountability and clarity of that, one of the things that the NAB rolled out a couple of years ago was making sure there's a very clear point of accountability for any change, because before that there was a little bit of finger pointing when things start to go wrong. And I think the CEO appointed sponsors, pulled them all in and said, I want one neck to choke effectively when things go wrong, one person to but it has changed behaviours and made things quite clear in terms of relationship between line one and line two. And to give you a sense, so I'm the sponsor of the project that's just delivered, thankfully. But this project has a PAB. I chair that PAB. I'm the single point of accountability around decision making. I have someone from line two who attends that PAB. I've got a very good relationship with that person from line two. And that's really, really important. Because that person from line two almost has the ability to be a veto on the project. And what I mean by that is there's an incredible power from someone on line two, because whilst I'm accountable for making a decision, if I ever had someone from line two tell me not to do something, like it's career suicide to go against that. And so the relationship I've got with my line two person is very much watch my back, and it's a big deal when you call me, because I'll be following you. And certainly the big question that gets asked when I have my performance review, on which there's bonuses, and my manager will ask line two, did Tim listen? That's his number one question. He'll go to line two and say, did Tim listen to you? And so there's a culture within the NAB of a bit of reverence to line two, really making sure you listen. And on the flip side, line two understand that they've got a massive responsibility, that if they start to call stuff, the business pretty well has to follow that. So line two, be a little bit careful about what you start telling the business to do. And so a really good line two, I think they've got great relationships with people who've got decision-making authority, but actually don't say a lot. They don't overstep the mark. In fact, it's a good meeting when I have a PAB and one who doesn't say a lot, because I know they're just there watching my back. They're ready to review and challenge. But if there's nothing to see and it's all, they don't need to say anything, and I respect that. But when they do speak, there's weight behind it, and I think that's what makes a really good line too, when there's just that understanding between line one, so who's got ownership for the risk, and line two, who's watching their back. And the other thing I would add is when there's a big call to make, it doesn't happen in the middle of PAB. A good line two will make a phone call beforehand, and they'll go and have their coffee chat, and the line two will be, I'm really uncomfortable with the direction this is heading, and so they work with you, and that's a really good line two. They'll work with you in partnership all the way through, and
I want to explain Thank you. What PAB is.
Sorry, our project advisory board. So it isn't decision making by committee. It's a sponsor makes a decision, but has a bunch of advisors who have the opportunity to advise the sponsor one way or the other. So,
that's good. Thanks. Elaine?
I just want to pick up on a comment you made somewhere on the earnings drops, and I think that's a fantastic point. As a non-risk manager, if the risk management team pitch up at your doorstep and ask you as the first thing to deal with them, please help me fill out a risk register, or talk about specific risks, you probably switch off. And I'm thinking of myself in a, as I say, in a non-risk environment. I think the key was, which is where you used the point, earnings drops. If they're pitching up to talk to you about what do you do, how can I help you, help you to actually be better at your functional role, I think it changes the ball game, and I think back to communication, that is a way for me that risk management sort of should be more focused. Maybe even getting rid of the word risk would be great. We spoke this morning about aged care. It's got a connotation like I'm going to stop something, but you're actually going to help them. Yes. Earning drops is a great way to think about it. That's a comment. I was interested on the second slide. There's a bit of a leading question there, Mike, one after that, where you talked about conduct risk. I was just curious, you asked the question. What are you doing to raise awareness of conduct risk? I thought it would be interesting for the panel to talk a little bit about what is conduct risk, and what does it actually mean, organisational agility?
Yes, please, mate.
Yeah,
thanks.
Conduct risk is the topic of the moment, isn't it? And I think ASIC have really raised the bar significantly. And the way I'd articulate it is roughly as follows. I think there are three simple questions that businesses need to be able to answer. One, how do we want people to behave? Can we clearly articulate that? Two, how do we know that people are behaving as they should? So there's a sort of an expectation and then a checking process. And the third one is, how can we identify pockets of the business where mine are all the right in there? And if there are pockets of the business where the people aren't behaving as you'd expect, I think you've got to ask yourself the question, how did our culture allow that to happen? And that's a really challenging question, I think. ASIC were quite widely in the press a couple of weeks ago, talking, essentially saying they're tired of hearing about bad apple excuses. So the challenge is, how do you find those bad apples, and how do you question whether the tree's actually rotten? Now that's a major challenge. I don't think any financial institution in Australia would be able to answer those three really quite simple questions And I think we need to be able to answer those. I think ASIC will be asking those questions of boards pretty quickly. I would if I was in their shoes.
Thanks, Mike.
Most important part of conduct is it comes back to risk as well, because you can put all the locks you want, all the controls that you want in place, but if the conduct isn't there and the people are unlocking the doors, you know, there's no point in having controls. We need the conduct to be right to ensure that the controls are working.
Actually, we think about market conduct even a little bit broader and go outside, and we're spending a lot of time trying to co-create with customers the products that we're going to sell. And I think if you're going to put the forward-looking view on, the number of things that are changing in the world from, I don't know, shared assets, 3D printing, cyber risk, genetic manipulation and the ability of the genome project. I mean, there's so many things out there changing, and we don't, big data and discrimination acts and data privacy acts, all these things are changing and changing very rapidly, and we've, as a society, got to react to it. And how is your conduct going to be assessed as society changes its opinions going forward? Is going to be the challenge for the financial services industry over the next 5 years. So getting a process that just doesn't... The inertia in a company, and it's okay because I've always done it this way, is amazingly strong. And how do you change that? So,
the ultimate challenge... Did you want to ask a question or make a comment?
More a comment on those comments. I actually typically work overseas, so it's so good to hear these perspectives about how things are moving in Australia. But I work in the banking software market, and recently there was a pretty big scandal when somebody hacked the central bank of Bangladesh and stole $81 million. And that money was diverted to the Philippines, where it went through a number of bank accounts and was withdrawn. Well, most of it was withdrawn. Now, the point about that issue is that there were actually controls in place that would have stopped that happening. But the culture wasn't there to make sure that those controls were applied properly. And that's really the issue in most Asian countries. How do you get the CEO to actually say that this is really important and we need to actually take action and pay more than lip service to this and actually hire the people who actually have the ability to look at those issues and understand what they are. So that's a much bigger challenge than you have in Australia.
Thanks very much. Well, we might finish on that note, and thanks everybody for involvement in the discussion, and we could keep going for hours, I suspect. So thank you very much, and particularly I want to thank each of the members of the panel, Tim, Mike, Simone, and Tim. And I've got a little prezi. And a special thanks to Tim Clark for getting all those hot topics in his last sentence.